So I'm delighted to have in this studio on Difficult Listening, Ross Bolitar and Eduardo Cossio here to talk about the release of Glint. Ross Bolitar, Eduardo Cossio, how are you going?
Great, thank you.
Hello, good to be mate.
Here. Oh, it's wonderful to have you all here. I should clear from the outset that there is definitely a sense of slight bias here in that I had a small hand in the technical work around this album, and you are both good friends of mine, so be under no impressions that this isn't a very biased interview. But you've both been very dear friends for a long time, and it's a real pleasure to have you in to chat. Ross, I wondered if we could start with you and maybe setting up some of the context for what came of the synchronous improvisation as a technique, I suppose. So this is late 1980s. What were you thinking?
I love the phrase, what were you thinking? Well, I think there was a kind of natural progression, which was only visible from here now, but wasn't at the time. But I think I started playing jazz initially at the Hilton, and that was as convergent as it could possibly be, staying together. Then from there, sort of an escape into modal jazz, which is also, highly convergent. Then various forms of free improvisation, to getting to the stage of free improvisation where no one would listen to anybody else. The initial versions were very timid. Everyone was listening like crazy, and it was kind of boring. The results were kind of boring. And I was fascinated because at the time it felt like chaos. But when I listened back afterwards, there were all kinds of unconscious connections happening, you know? And I think, that's really interesting. And we're all in the same room, but what about if we weren't in the same room? You know, like if all these convergences are happening unconsciously, why do we need to be in the same room? Perhaps it could happen at a distance. So I got together initially with Phil Koukoulas, who's my friend, the bass player in the Black Eyed Susans. We both played in the Black Eyed Susans. I have to get this a rock thing here. It's my one opportunity for my life. So, sure, I've got that off my chest. But we had lots of fun doing other stuff and listening to Charles Ives, which he really loved. And so he played in, he set up in City Beach, his home. I set up in Mount Lawley. We had a recorder at each end, and there was a new discussion about instrumentation or just the length of time, starting precisely on time and playing for a precise time, but no other content at all, except that each person should write a poem again completely with no information to the other person about it.
I read you wrote an extensive essay on the topic called Improvising with Synchronistic Experiences, which was published in the New Music Articles magazine in 1991.
Wow.
I did my research. And I vaguely remember that there was a lot of discussion at that time around dreams and some of the relationship between that and some of these synchronous experiences that we not just have in music but in day-to-day life.
Absolutely, yes.
Tell me a bit about your second, I suppose, synchronous experience, synchronous improvisation
That's wonderful.
With Richard Ratajczak.
That one.
Yeah.
Richard was in Sydney. It was October the 9th.
1989.
And we played for about 37 minutes. It's very complicated where the actual signals and all that went. There was an audience at Pika with two radios, one receiving Richard from Sydney and the other one receiving me from nearby. And it also went off in other directions, but then it was also broadcast all over Australia. West Australia was 2 hours later, so able to go home and listen to it, you know, which was wonderful. And it's Rowan Hammond, who's a student at uni, I think a PhD student at that time, analysed Similar Play 2, that time Similar Play 2, and identified some synchronistic experience, but also raised the issue that when you have a lot of congruence happening, like a melody and accompaniment type situations, it sounds totally synchronistic, but there's all kinds of caveats that need to be introduced. At one end is strict identity, where both play the same thing at the same time. Synchronous silences, which are wonderful. The first piece I ever did had 15-second silence with the one with Phil Koukoulas, which was amazing, you know? That kind of thing, all the way to highly congruent textures, which, yeah, they could be synchronistic.
Would you like to hear some of that again?
Yeah! I haven't heard it since 1989.
So this is, I just picked a choice 3-minute section this 26-minute piece. It came out on the album Crow Country, which is released by Pogus, and also WARPS, which is the World Association for Ruined Piano Studies, Ross Bolliter's own record label. Pogus is home to lots of wonderful improvising musicians over the years, like Pauline Oliveros, and you know, a lot of the who's who of new music in America in some ways. And this is the third track from Crow Country, That Time, Simul Play 2, conceived and devised by Ross Bolliter, with Bolliter playing piano and Richard Bratajczak playing double bass in Sydney, while Ross is playing in Perth. Here we go. there we have a little excerpt of that time Simul Play 2 from Crow Country in 2000, but that was recorded in 1989, and Ross Bolitar and Richard Ratajczak could not hear each other. They were both performing at the exact same time, albeit one in Sydney, one in Perth. And it's a cohesive piece of work. Which I wanted to read an excerpt from your essay, which you wrote about this. And Eduardo, maybe I can bring you in here. It says, I think you've just explained in the essay the Richard Ratajczak, that the performance of that. And you write, from the perspective of the musicians and the audience, anything could happen. So it is surprising that what does happen is so orderly, so complementary, and cohesive. Why do you think that is?
There's a wonderful essay by F. David Peete, from his book, actually, where he says, axisynchronicity is like a vast fire underlying everything. We only occasionally register sparks from that fire. So I would lean on that kind of poetic metaphysics.
Eduardo, any thoughts?
I think it's an experiment on listening back, you know, it's for the musicians when they listen back to themselves, and also for the audience, having that knowledge of how the thing was put together. It brings another layer into the experience, you know. And, you know, because the focus is on sound, that piece that we just heard made so much sense to me. I thought the playing was formidable. I haven't seen you play like that before, Ross. And also, like, hearing Richard, someone I hear a lot from you, Ross, but, you know, I haven't really heard him on record, you know, so very spirited and on the same wavelength. And I think, you know, comes from a relationship. I mean, you played a lot together back then, and we played together quite a lot, so therefore we have an upcoming album following the synchronous strategy.
I really like on the back of, you've shown me a sample of the physical copy of Glint, which is about to come out, and you use the phrase casting a net of synchronicities. I feel like you talk a bit about the poetic metaphysics of synchronous improvisation. What does that metaphor mean to you, of casting a net of synchronicities?
I think it's deeply unconscious. So casting a net, the metaphor's a little bit misleading, I feel. Casting a net for synchronicities, except that it's kind of not knowing what will swim into the net at all. And I think the more of the not knowing there is, somehow the more that seems to happen.
Eduardo maybe a little bit cheekily shared an excerpt from Alfred Hitchcock's film Shadow of a Doubt, in which the main character talks about telepathy and goes to a telegraphy place and asks about telepathy.
Oh my God!
And I thought that would be interesting to reflect on the fact that these improvisations happen at the same time. And yes, of course, synchronicity, it's maybe not easily explained by rational science, but the very poetic option of telepathy is a very interesting one in improvisation.
Yeah. But it's, I guess it's also like the nature of a lot of experimental music where the outcomes are quite open and unforeseeable in a way. And that's why you make the music. It's some kind of an act of discovery, you know. Can we make this work? Because it is possible that the performance will be unsuccessful. But it also happens that you will be surprised, and that surprise can be shared, it is hope that it will be of interest to others, you know. But it's really bringing these elements into our music making that bring a new openness, something unforeseeable and perhaps surprising, and a new knowledge. I mean, this music has come about from this way of making. Couldn't have been done otherwise. That's how it exists, you know. I mean, that Ross and Richard playing back in 1991. I mean, that's beautiful. I'm glad I heard it. but, you know, it's also music that allows for doubt. Shadow of a Doubt, that Hitchcock movie. and, you know, it's also good to admit doubt in music making. Not everything has to convince you to buy the thing, you know? I mean, it's okay to question. Are these guys for real, you know? It's totally fine to question how we make this thing, you know?
it begs the question, maybe this is a little bit of stoking the fire a bit, but what would be a bad synchronous improv?
One that doesn't sound like it's consciously put together.
I see. Because I feel like just on a technical level, when you're playing, and you know, I've recorded you doing a few of these, Ross, where you play with an openness for what is about to come, or for what will be happening when you layer things over each other, and I'm not sure where that thought goes, but
yeah. I do, but I don't. It's not consciously allowing. It seems quite natural when nothing else is happening to actually stop. I mean, I'm strongly aware of the environment and the sounds that are in the environment, so I stop and that swims up. So, but I certainly go along with you when, by leaving a lot of open space, it allows for other things to be happening, which I can't even possibly imagine what they will be. But yeah, it's an interesting question.
Mm. Eduardo, do you feel like it's an unconscious thing for you?
Well, I guess you know, when you're performing, in a way you are bringing up things, trying to summon things. You have your own, you know, your own threats that you're going through, and plus being aware of the space or any distractions, a noisy neighbor, for example, a dog that barks, you know. But you know, it's the sound you have at hand, and it's really the music admits for all of that, you know, and it's you dealing. As you deal with sounds all the time, you know, you choose to follow some and forget others, you know. But you know, this music, we chose a few chunks for sharing. Some others may not see the light of day. We chose, and you know, what we are presenting is a continuous, non-edited chunk of our improvisation. We played for 2 hours that night in November last year. Mm. And I was surprised at the surrealness of the whole thing. It's really vertiginous, if there's a word like that, you know? Like
vertiginous, yeah.
Vertiginous thing, you know? It's like a dream sequence. And there is this quite a vivacious thing going on. At times it's very, very, very funny, you know, because, you know, you are playing in this unguarded way. There is no audience. There is no counterpart to you. I mean, you're playing on your own, so you can take risks that you wouldn't normally play with your partner or, you know, your collaborator. So maybe allows for the tap to be open, you know, and you just, well, I mean, for example, I hardly ever play synthesizers when I'm performing in front of others, you know. But I chose to play them in this recording because why not, you know? And that made a whole difference. The music It has this kind of kaleidoscopic kind of vibe.
Mm.
I mentioned to you this song by the Beatles called For the Benefit of Mr. Kite on Sgt. Pepper. So some parts of our music reminds me of that very collage-y kind of thing, you know?
One thing I found really enjoyable listening to Glint is, I think the kaleidoscopic thing, but almost some cultural jamming in a way where sometimes with the accordion you can't not associate it with a particular time and place and a particular style of music and the locale and environment and some of your synths just sound very like dance music but very abstracted in a very weird way. Do you think much about these, I suppose, culture shifts in your work?
I don't think about it at all in advance. The Last Tango in Paris quote there grew quite naturally out of other things that were happening on the accordion. And then I love that sequence of minor chords, minor ninth chords, that it's literally the entire thing virtually is like it's got a couple of other chords, but I just got carried away and kept going, and then it melded into flowed into something else from there.
I didn't catch the Last Tango to Paris reference, but thank you for that.
No, that's fine. But normally I don't set out to do that. Sometimes things will float up and they become irresistible, and so And it seemed, listening back, quite compatible with what you were doing. I love the low booms. I can't do it with my voice.
Yeah,
that was there. I was falling sometimes on the beat as well, or in that beautiful way that a very low bass sound shouldn't fall right on the beat. It should be slightly after. And it's just mind blowing.
But you know, like Ross, when you and I talk about music, we talk a lot about songs. You know, we love. I mean, like most people, you know, we love a good melody. It's not that they will be abundant in this release, but sometimes it's that songwriter composer thing. You know, bringing a melody out of formlessness and then going back into it, you know. All the music is available because we have played that music. I mean, I was a songwriter, and I at some point was quite into jazz and classical music, and I worked my way through the repertoire and I loved it, you know. It's music I really hold quite dear, and I'm happy I can draw into it.
I have two tracks that I was going to play before we play the final Glint excerpt and wrap up the interview. I can't decide now because you've spoken about melodies, and I want to play the last track of Such and Such with that beautiful piano, or an excerpt of just with that beautiful piano melody you do at the end of Such and Such, or La Compañía del Otro from your Dark Shine synchro improv. Do you have a choice?
Oh, I love the Such and Such.
Oh, it's such a beautiful bit. All right, so this is an album called Such and Such. Do you want to actually explain a little bit about how this album came out?
It's our duo release we made last year, and this is a live recording. Ross and I are, you know, improvising together at Ross's kitchen with five, six pianos. I'm playing scissors and electronics, and Ross is on these amazing instruments. And you are recording us, Michael. You're in the picture.
It may be worth saying that this particular record, most of it came out of a 3-hour jam.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And most of the good stuff happened in the second half when you're both pretty tired and out of it.
That was kind of, a prompt we put on ourselves. Let's see what happens when we play for 3 hours. And the whole house was mic'd up, you know. The front yard had a mic, the living room had a mic, because there are instruments in these spaces. And throughout the 3 hours, we paced around the whole house, in the porch, in the living room. But yeah, as you mentioned, Michael, the core of Such and Such comes from that last hour.
So this is the last 5 minutes of that wonderful album called Such and Such by Eduardo Cossio and Ross Bolitar.